Friends, life is hard. Relationships are complicated. And more often than any of us would like, we find ourselves living in the gray areas of life. The areas where the right thing to do feels foggy or at best unclear. The place where we are faced with a myriad of decisions and overwhelming uncertainty about the right path that we are to take. And often, because of the complexity and hardship of life, we are left asking the question, what is the right thing to do in any given circumstance? It's this very question that reminds me of a scene from Ted Lasso. If you haven't seen the series, I'm not giving my pastoral recommendation because of language, but it's a good show. And if you don't know, the series follows an American football coach, Ted Lasso, who serendipitously decides to coach a Premier League soccer team and all the challenging relational and pragmatic situations that a decision like that would inherently bring up. And in the series, one of the coaches, through a series of events, betrays Ted and not only decides to begin coaching another team who's his opponent, but in the process reveals confidential information about Ted that deeply wounds him. And when the opportunity, through a series of events, an opportunity arises for this coach who's betrayed Ted and the rest of the coaching staff to rejoin them, Ted is willing to forgive this other coach and offer him a second chance. But his assistant coach, Coach Beard, as he is called, both in anger and in hurt from the betrayal that took place, and also with a desire to protect somebody he cares about, and Ted refuses to extend the second chance, even going as far as to call the person who betrayed Ted Judas. Now, this assistant coach finds himself in a gray area. He's left a fork in the road, if you will. I could A, choose to protect myself, the team, and my dear friend, and the entire organization from somebody who, when given the opportunity, betrayed us. And not only betrayed us and took another job, but betrayed us in our confidentiality, our trust, things that happened behind the scenes, and he put it all out for the world to see. That's a line you do not cross. And so I would be wise to keep him away, or we could choose to bring him back, incur the risk that another betrayal or wounding could bring up, and strive, if at all possible, to rebuild what they had lost. In this place of decision, Ted, in typical Ted Lasso fashion, thoughtfully reminds his assistant coach of a moment when he himself had been given grace at his lowest moment. And it is in thinking about his own life and how he had been treated in that moment that he decides what he should do next. He drives over to the other coach's house, and this is that scene. It's a little hard to see there, but there's Coach Beard. You can see how he got that name, standing with the other coach who betrayed Ted. And here's what he had to say. He said, "Ted and I met playing football, and after school, we went our separate ways. He got into coaching, and I got into prison. When I got paroled, I had no money. Family didn't want me. I had nowhere to go. And I looked up Ted, and he took me in, fed me, and let me crash on his couch. And in return, I stole his car. Now, I didn't get very far, and I would have gone straight back to prison if Ted didn't come down there to the police station and convince those cops that he gave me the car. I stole from my friend, who forgave me, gave me a job, and a life. So in honor of that, I forgive you, and I offer you a job, and the life part is up to you." After this moment, they embrace and the other coaches welcome back onto the team. But it raises the question, what is the right thing to do? You have all sorts of situations in your life, relationships, circumstances, just like this one, where you have a myriad of options and decisions and paths to go down. And I know that all of us wish that there was a GPS to help us navigate through the decisions we have to make in life. Like, this is the right route to go, or turn left in 20 feet, and that would be the way for us to navigate these things. But unfortunately, or fortunately, life just doesn't work that way. And so when left asking the question, what is the right thing to do, Jesus provides us a question to begin that process by asking, and it's this: how would I want to be treated? How would I want to be treated? Today we continue in our series, The Sermon on the Mount, the good news of the kingdom of God, where all summer we have been working our way through the largest collection of Jesus' teaching, and arguably his most famous. Now, we can divide Jesus' sermon into three larger sections. There's the introduction, where Jesus announces the surprising identity of those who are a part of God's kingdom. It is the poor, it's the outcast, it's the forgotten. And these are the very people who God is going to use to bring about his purposes. And Jesus invites them to be salt and light into the world. And from this, Jesus goes into the main body of his sermon. Here, Jesus has been exploring this idea of righteousness, which is to say what it looks like to live in right relationship with God and others. And finally, Jesus closes his sermon with the conclusion. At this conclusion, Jesus presents a call to make a choice about how we're going to respond to Jesus' sermon, represented in three images: two gates, two trees, and two houses. Now, I reestablish that framework to say that here, this morning, what we have before us is not just an abstract idea that Jesus is tossing in at the end of his sermon, but it is a well-crafted and carefully thought out conclusion to the section on relationships and to the larger conversation about this idea of righteousness. And so this leads us to arguably Jesus' most famous teaching ever. So in everything, do to others what you would have them do to you. For this sums up the law and the prophets. This teaching has become known as the golden rule. And chances are you've heard some form of this saying. It can be found everywhere, from business ethic policies to presidential speeches to classroom posters and even company mission statements. These words of Jesus have transcended every imaginable barrier. Time, culture, language, you name it, these words have persevered. In fact, I even remember as a child, I was racking my brain this week because we used to have this whole like morning routine in school where we'd have to say the pledge in both English and Spanish. And then we did this thing where we like took a student pledge. I don't know what it's called. I scrounged the internet for it, could not find it. But as a part of that, we used to have to like solemnly swear that we would treat others the way we wanted to be treated every single morning. Now, whether or not we did that was a different question, but at least we said it and solemnly swore every morning that we would do that. And so a form of this teaching is in the cultural air that you and I breathe. Now, funny enough, most of us don't know where it got its name, the Golden Rule, from, but as we do a little bit of research, here's what we find. We find that it gets its name all the way back from the second century, where Emperor Alexander Severus, there he is there, a handsome guy, came across this teaching of Jesus, and though not a Christian, thought it so brilliant, he had it inscribed on the palace walls in pure gold, hence the name, the Golden Rule. Now, to be clear, this teaching of Jesus isn't exactly original to him. However, as we will see, in typical Jesus fashion, he left his fingerprints of brilliance all over it. There's a famous story surrounding this, a similar saying in Jesus' day. At the time, there's two famous teachers. There is Rabbi Shammai and Rabbi Hillel. You might remember them from Jesus' teaching about divorce because Jesus is responding to the positions they have taken about the topic. Now, the story goes that a Gentile came up to Rabbi Shammai and said to him, "I will convert to Judaism on one condition, that you can teach me the whole Torah while I stand on one foot." Now, Shammai, being the more conservative, conservative theologically, famously chased him away with a really big stick. Now, he took that same question, that Gentile, to Rabbi Hillel and asked him the same thing. And here's what Rabbi Hillel had to say. "What is hateful to do to you, don't do to your neighbor. That is the whole Torah. The rest is commentary. Go and learn." That's what he told him. Now, we can find other versions of that similar saying in various wisdom traditions spanning a long period of time. But that version of the rule became known as the silver rule. Ethicists have argued there's at least three rules to live by: the golden rule, the silver rule, and the wooden rule. First, the wooden rule. Here's this framework. Do to others what they do to you. Do to others what they do to you. In this view, we do to other people what they do to us. If they're mean to us, we're mean to them. If they lie to us, we lie to them. And this is known as the law of retaliation, or what we colloquially say, tit for tat, right? You do this, I do that, that's how things go. Someone hurts your feelings, you give them the silent treatment. Someone is driving real close behind you. I mean, really close behind you. So you just tap on the brake to let them know, "I see you, and you're not going to get away with that." Someone takes forever to text you back. So you decide, "Well, then I'm just going to ghost them all together." Right? Now, I know no one in this room does anything like that, but that is the framework. Now, it's not always negative. There's positive expressions of this, right? So like you go to a coffee shop with a friend and they get your coffee, and so next time you get their coffee. Or someone compliments your new jacket, and so you compliment their shoes, and it's this exchange of niceties back and forth. In essence, to live by the wooden rule is to treat others how they treat you, for good or for bad. Now, next up the maturity ladder is that of the silver rule, which is don't do to others what you don't want them to do to you. At a base level, this is a massive leap forward from the wooden rule. With the silver rule, it is an invitation to restrain from doing to others what you don't want done to you. For example, I don't want other people to gossip about me, therefore, I don't gossip about other people. I don't want other people cut in front of me in line while I'm waiting, so I'm mindful of not doing that to others. I don't like it when my emails go ignored, so I am sure to respond with prompt replies. Now, to be clear, this is great and a good paradigm to begin, but this isn't what Jesus is saying here. Notice, there are key differences between what Jesus says here and what has been said before. The silver rule, as it is known, is framed in the negative, whereas Jesus' teaching, the golden rule, is framed in the positive. Now, for you, this might sound like semantics, but there's a huge difference here. There's a massive difference between not doing something and doing something. Here's what I mean. Don't hate anyone. That's a good place to start. But that is not the same as love your enemy. Don't cut in line. Solid. I think we could agree with that. Golden rule. Be patient with other people. Whole different ballgame. Do you see what I'm saying? So it is basically consensus that Jesus is the first person in human history to articulate this idea in the positive. So the idea of the golden rule is not the idea is not original to Jesus, but the escalation of the rule is unique to Jesus. For Jesus, it's not simply enough to not do evil. We have to become people who do good. Or said another way, to do to others what we'd have them do to us. Jesus wants these words to function as a compass for his people, to help us navigate the gray areas of our lives. So in everything, do to others as you would have them do to you. We come back to the question, what's the right thing to do? Now, frankly, there's no one size fits all for that question. Every situation, every circumstance brings complexity, nuance, challenges, and context. And for all of that, we need wisdom, which Jesus has already instructed us to ask for. But if we're ever wondering, what's the best first step? Well, this is the place to begin. We begin by stopping and reflecting on that key question. How would I want to be treated? What we noted is that according to Jesus, we should be asking this question in every situation and in all of our relationships. We should be asking this question in every situation and in all of our relationships. Notice the line, in everything. Now, here's what's super cool about the Greek here. It means in everything. It means in every circumstance, in every possible scenario. The language here is emphatic. Jesus is saying in all things, in all situations, at all times. Not when I feel like it, not when I've had my coffee first, not when I have a full belly, but in all situations, we are to do this. And then he says to do this to others. That word for others in Greek is the word anthropos, which is where we get our word anthropology, which means everyone, all humanity, not just our friends and our family, but our coworkers, our fellow citizens, our community, and even our enemies. For Jesus, we are to ask this question of ourselves in everything and to everyone. Scholar Michael Wilkins says, Jesus declares that the golden rule is the normative manifestation of his followers' discipleship. In other words, living according to this rule is a way of being in the world for a follower of Jesus. What Jesus is teaching us to do here is to have what's called active imaginative empathy. Active imaginative empathy. Let's break that down. First, empathy. Now, chances are you're familiar with the word at some level, but the word is a compound word. M meaning in or into, and pathy meaning feeling, experience, or even suffering. Empathy literally means into experience or in feeling. In other words, to empathize is to enter into another's experience. Now, in recent years, there's been a lot of discussion about whether or not empathy is helpful, especially for those among us who very easily take on the emotional weight of other people. And so what I want to do for just a brief moment is tease out the difference between two kinds of empathy. There's cognitive empathy and there's affective empathy. Cognitive empathy, sometimes called mentalizing, is the ability to recognize and understand how another person could be feeling based on your own experience. Whereas affective empathy, often called experience sharing, is feeling what another person is feeling as if it was you. So one is to imagine what I would feel if I were that person. The other is to take on the other person's emotions as if they were my own. Now, there's been a ton of research done into why affective empathy, literally feeling the feelings of others, isn't exactly helpful, right? If your world is falling apart and then all of a sudden I'm come to help you and my world starts falling apart because your world's falling apart, we're all falling apart, people, you know? No, but someone's got to pull us out of this place, right? Whereas cognitive empathy, we can resonate with the feeling that you are feeling, be with you in that experience, and help you navigate your time in it. Two different frameworks for empathy. And so this leads us to our next word, which is imaginative. The practice Jesus invites us here is one of our imagination. John Stott says this, "Self-advantage often guides us in our own affairs. Now, we must also let it guide us in our behavior to others. All we have to do is use our imagination. Put ourselves in other people's shoes and ask, how would I like to be treated in that situation?" We naturally think about what benefits us all the time. All the time, we are actively thinking about what would be good for us. From small decisions like the kind of coffee you want to drink in the morning or whatever it is to start your day, to large decisions about the kind of career that you choose or the person you choose to spend your time with. All of us are curating our lives based off of what we think would be good for us, and we do this all the time. Jesus is inviting us to do that very thing now for other people. In the plans that we make and the decisions we make, and the way we carefully design our own lives that would benefit us, we are to use that same instinct towards others. In that moment, we are to imagine, if I were them, what would I want someone to do for me? We come back to this scene in Ted Lasso. The brilliance of that scene is the golden rule lived out. Ted helps the assistant coach engage in imaginative empathy when he has him reflect on his own story and think about when he was in a similar place and how he was responded to in that moment. In other words, when we mess up, how do we want to be treated? When we mess up, how do we want to be treated? I don't know about you, but I want grace upon grace upon grace. I don't know about you, but I want forgiveness. I don't know about you, but I want the benefit of the doubt. I don't know about you, but I want understanding, empathy. We are to imagine, with our own experience, what it would like to be this other person. And in that moment, extend to them grace. Lastly, this is active. Notice that Jesus says we are to do to others, not think about others, not imagine about others, but active, do to others. Our practice of imaginative empathy has to be active. We have to do something about it. Scott McKnight says this, "The simple pause to reflect on what we would like done to us unleashes a zillion acts of kindness, goodness, and mercy. Not an occasional act, but a zillion and even more." We are to not only think about how we want to be treated, but then to take the next step and actually treat that person in the way we would want to be treated. Not just to say, oh, they must be going through something today, but to say, are you okay? Did you need help with something? How can I support right now? Et cetera, et cetera. That's what we're being invited into. Now, with this, Jesus is putting before us a whole new way of seeing our relationships. Jonathan Pennington, a scholar, says this, Matthew 7:12, beautifully summarizes the way of being in the world that no amount of rules or regulations could ever encompass or hope to promote. The golden rule is not so much a rule, but a vision. It is an invitation to virtue by giving a vision of how to relate to other people. I love that paradigm shift. It's not a rule to follow as much as it is a vision to live into that Jesus is putting before us today. And so here's the question I have for you. How would the world around you change if you actually began to live this way? How would the world around you change if you actually began to live this way? Now, we could take like the world as a whole, but I'm literally talking about your world, your family members, your coworkers, the people that you interact with on a daily basis. How would the world around you radically change if you began to actually live this practice out? My hunch is that the possibilities are endless for the amount of good that can be done if you were just to live in this way. Now, the golden rule is meant for us to be a compass, to help us navigate the complex world that we find ourselves in. But here's what's also really interesting. The golden rule is also a powerful conclusion. Jesus chooses these words not only to close out his section on judging others, or even as a capstone to a section on relationships, but also to conclude the entire reflection on this idea of righteousness. The golden rule is Jesus' final word in his sermon before he moves to his closing thoughts. So, if I can, for just a few minutes, can we Bible nerd out together? Okay, this is so cool. I couldn't leave this out of the sermon. So, in this section, what has Jesus been talking about? He's been talking about relationships. And Jesus begins this section with a clear command: do not judge, right? And then from that moment, he goes on to help us realize how we categorize and condemn others and how that is only a thing that God can do. And to do that, he further illustrates his point of us not judging with two pictures. The first is about someone who has a giant beam sticking out of their eye, and another person who has a little speck of sawdust in theirs. Now, the person with the big old beam is worried about the person with the speck of sawdust in their eye, saying, hey, man, you should really watch out. I think you have something in your eye. And the purpose of the story is to be ridiculous on purpose. That is absolutely absurd that somebody would do that. That's exactly Jesus' point. And what Jesus is pointing to is our propensity to focus on the faults and failures of others and ignore our own. So Jesus says, examine yourself first. Not that your brother doesn't need to get sawdust out of his eye, but first pull the beam out of your own before you tell him about his sawdust. Now next, Jesus goes on to this strange riddle, if we're honest, where he says, don't give pearls to swines and sacred things to dogs, which I don't think any of you are planning to have in your schedule this week, but that's what Jesus says. And we realize that this is not an abstract riddle, but actually Jesus is teaching us not to give away wisdom, which is associated with pearls, or things of immense value, sacred food, to those who do not want it or cannot perceive its value. That's what Jesus is saying here. Then after that, Jesus anticipates all these questions that would arise for so many of us for how do we know? How do we know when to like make a good judgment call? How do we know when to say something? How do I know when the beam's out of my eye? Because, you know, I think the beam's out of my eye and then I find out it's actually not out of my eye. And so when do I say something? And is it someone else's responsibility to tell them about the sawdust? Because when do I do it? All these questions start rising up. Jesus is like, yup, you need something for that. You need wisdom. So you need to ask. You need to seek, and you need to knock. And God's a good and generous Father who will give you what you need when you ask, so he'll give you wisdom when you need it. That's Jesus' paradigm. So you can see this is a progression that Jesus is working on here. This isn't just a bunch of random thoughts and teaching. This is all one coherent teaching about how we navigate relationships. And the culmination of this is Jesus' teaching the golden rule. Fundamentally, do to others what you would want them to do to you. Jesus is summarizing everything he just said in a simple principle, which is that treat other people the way you would want to be treated. Do you want to be judged? Do you want someone pointing out sawdust when they got beams out of their own eye? Do you want someone who's just trying to force feed you wisdom at every turn and corner of your life? You don't want those things? Good, don't do them to other people. That's essentially what Jesus is saying here. Now, that would be cool if that's all Jesus was doing here. But that's not all Jesus is doing here. This entire section is about righteousness, which I know is like such a church word. I don't think you go around asking people about their righteousness or explaining your own. But as we've said multiple times, that righteousness is right relationships with God and other people. That's what this whole section is about. Now, Jesus has been teaching about what it looks like to live in right relationship with God and others, and he summarizes that very idea with the golden rule, saying what it looks like to live in God's way towards other people fundamentally is to treat other people the way they want to be treated. Now, that would be cool if all that was all Jesus was doing here, but he's also doing something else. Jesus begins this entire section with a provocative statement where he says that he has come to fulfill the Torah. He has come to fulfill the scriptures. And then at the end of his sermon, he says this, that this teaching summarizes the law and the prophets. Jesus is putting a bookend here on this idea of righteousness. Now, quickly, Jonathan Pennington says this, the golden rule serves multiple structural roles, summing up the exhortation to evaluate each other fairly, concluding the theme of greater righteousness in relation to the world, and even more broadly, providing the right-handed bookend to the whole central section on the sermon. And so what Jesus is concluding here is that both he himself and this practice somehow sum up all of the scriptures in the Old Testament. Jesus says, for this sums up the law and the prophets. Now, later in Matthew's gospel, a Bible scholar comes to Jesus and says, what is the greatest commandment? And what does Jesus tell him? Well, he quotes from Deuteronomy and he says, to love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. That's the first. And he says, the second is like it. To love your neighbor as what? As yourself. Jesus summarizes the entire Old Testament by loving God and loving others as yourself. Notice that phrase, as yourself. If you truly love yourself, you're not going to do things to yourself that you would hate. And you wouldn't do that to you would and if you wouldn't do that to yourself, why would you do it to someone else? That's the flip of the golden rule. Your love for yourself becomes the guide for how you act towards others. This line here at the end is Jesus' summary of his summary. He is summarizing the back half of love others as yourselves with this phrase, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Again, Pennington. The golden rule can easily be understood as an aphoristic wisdom version of the second greatest commandment, to love one's neighbor as oneself. Jesus is boiling his entire sermon down into a single phrase. And we could do that by bringing it to a single word. The purpose of Jesus' entire sermon is love. That's what it all boils down to. The final word of Jesus' sermon before he gets into his conclusion is love. That's what Jesus is essentially boiling this all down to. Dallas Willard, Jesus says in the law and the prophets, in other words, this is love. And everything that is intended for us by God is included within it. Friends, that's the golden rule in its essence. This is how we love other people as ourselves, is by doing to them what we would want done to us. Scott McKnight put this brilliant line. He says, there is nothing complex about this most simple of moral maxims. Its difficulty is in the doing, not in the knowing. There is a simple reciprocity at work. The very thing, whatever it is, that you want others to do to you, that very thing, whatever it is, that you should do to others. So where the rubber really meets the road, friends, is practicing the golden rule. That's where the rubber meets the road. Jesus' teaching here is probably the shortest that we've had so far in the series. I know Elise was relieved when she got the message of how little she had to read up here in front of you all, a single sentence. I'm notorious for giving people like 20 verses or something like that. But in its simplicity, there is a universe to explore. And in its simplicity, the real challenge is in our obedience to it. So how do we practice the golden rule? Well, you know what the golden rule is, but what I would like to do as we close is give you some helpful handles on you as you integrate this into your life. The first thing is this: you need to slow down. You need to slow down. Friends, love and hurry are incompatible. Love and hurry are incompatible. When you are always living your life at a frenetic pace, you cannot think about how others want to be treated and how you would want to be treated if you were them. You're just not moving at a pace sustainable for that. When you are running late for something, how loving are you? When you're running late for something, how loving are you? How are you in traffic when you're 10 minutes late going to work? Are you letting everybody in, letting people merge? Or are you the one who's getting real close to the person driving slow in front of you? Are you the one saying things under your breath that you shouldn't be saying? How, I know the parents, other parents in the room could resonate with this, trying to get out of the door somewhere with kids. That is the greatest mission on planet Earth, is just to get somewhere with kids running around and they forgot their jacket and one of them doesn't have a shoe for a reason and one of them is eating a snack that's spilled all over. It's like, how do we possibly leave this place, right? It's like, you find me in that moment, my love meter is pretty low. When we live at a hurried pace, it makes love impossible. We don't have the bandwidth, the space, the time to engage in imaginative empathy towards others, or even to act on that thing when we move at such a pace. And so the invitation from some of you this morning may be to slow down so that you can become a person of love to those in your life. The second thing I'd say is this: remain curious. Remain curious. It is our propensity to make decisions about other people, i.e. Jesus' language, judge them harshly and not extend to them grace and come to conclusions in our mind about them. So, for example, you're going through the line at Starbucks and the barista's rude to you. You're like, oh, what's wrong with her? I don't know what her deal is. Your whole day is going in that direction. When it's literally, you have no idea what it's like. Maybe the customer in front of her, in front of you, was terribly rude to her. You know what I'm saying? And again, that doesn't give her license to be whatever she is. But if I were a barista at Starbucks in a line at 6 o'clock in the morning and there's 20 cars waiting, how would I want to be treated? Probably with kindness. Hey, are you doing okay today? I hope you have a great day. Whatever the thing may be. Remain curious. Curiosity is what leads us to want to even put ourselves in other people's shoes. And the greatest tool I can give you to remaining curious is learn how to be somebody who asks questions. Rather than coming to decisions and conclusions already in your mind, become someone who in love reaches out to another through thoughtful question asking. What's front and center for you right now? What feels heavy right now? What does support from me look like right now? And allow that curiosity to stretch in you empathy. And lastly, I want to say, extend grace. The scriptures say, love covers a multitude of sins. What would it look like for you to make a commitment to do your very best to not be somebody who's easily offendable, but be someone who's got such a reservoir of grace, you're constantly pouring it out on other people, even when they treat you in a way that you don't want to be treated? Instead, you respond in grace back. Would you join me in standing? We're going to enter into a time of response now. Because here at Zion, we don't want to be people who just hear God's word, but we want to be people who respond to God's word as it is spoken to us. And I just sense that there's a couple of invitations for us in the room this morning. The first is that right now the Spirit just been speaking to you about how busy you are and the pace that you're living at. And that you aren't even able to think about how you should treat others based on how you would want to be treated because you're just far too busy. You're moving at a frenetic pace. And the Spirit is inviting you this morning to slow down and to move at the pace of love. If that's you this morning, you need to slow down and move at the pace of love. I want to invite you to respond on this side of the room. And again, the way we respond is just coming forward with our hands open, and someone will lay a hand on your shoulder and pray for you, pray blessing over you as you respond to what God is speaking to you this morning. I also have a sense that there are some of you right now with really difficult relationships in your life. And as we were having this chat, the Spirit was bringing those people to mind. And you were not wanting to deal with that at all. You wanted to exclude them from being a person you treat in this way because they're X, Y, Z, 1, 2, 3, whatever, you fill in the blank. And the Spirit's saying, no, them. I want you to treat them the way you want to be treated. I want you to extend love towards them. If that's you, if you have a really difficult, hard relationship or situation that you need in God's strength and grace to face tomorrow or this week, I want to invite you to come over this section and you just hands open. Someone will pray blessing over you to be strengthened and encouraged to live in the way that God's calling you to live. And just lastly, I just keep hearing the phrase, just wounded, that there's just been some people in the room who have just been hurt so deeply. And my sense is that it's even and especially from people who have called themselves followers of Jesus. And this practice to treat others the way that you've been treated, you've been hurt so bad. You've been cut so deep. It just feels like you don't even have the bandwidth in you to do that. I believe that Jesus this morning wants to bring about healing in that area. And he wants to set you free to become a person of love. So if that's you, respond here in the center. So if you need to slow down, if you need to bring God a difficult relationship or situation, and if you need healing to become who God is calling you to be, let's respond now.